I think that probably, yeah, that looks better. Great. Thank you very much for being out there, everybody. That was Long Live Rock and Roll by Rainbow from the album of the same name. Before that, Love Struck Baby from Stevie Ray Vaughan. What a guitarist, eh? And a Fire in the Mountain tune before that from a band called Opaque, called New Beginnings, which I hope is what we're going to start seeing. Seems to me that we probably are, bit by bit, round and about us. Well, I'm really glad to say that tonight I'm joined once again by Mark Moxham and Simon Spaniard from youandyourcash.com. Thanks very much for joining us again, gentlemen.
Hola.
It's a pleasure.
And tonight I'm hoping to examine a little bit about insurance. As you know, Simon, it was your Welcome to the Rabbit Hole DVD number 5 which really entertained me on this subject. Had you told me 10 years ago that I'd be endeavouring to host a 2-hour radio show on the subject of insurance, I would have thought you were mad. But it actually is quite a ripping yarn, isn't it?
Well, I think it's got a few important implications with regards to insurance, and then what we link to insurance in by way of limited liability and how we think of liability.
Yeah. So where did it start? Why did people start? Where and when did people start paying other people insurance on things?
I think in the DVD, I was commenting on a film that I'd watched. It was a black and white matinee made in 1936 called, funnily enough, Lloyd's of London. And anyone wants to see a copy or see the film, in fact, the whole film on the White Rabbit Trust YouTube channel. I'm sure you can get it on Google anyway.
I just posted the link into the chat box. There you go.
And, you know, I'd watched the film. I'm a big fan of films now, even more so, since kind of waking up and realizing that we get a lot of real pertinent messages in some of these Hollywood blockbusters and, some of the serials that we see on TV. I know most of it is complete baloney, but, there are some real pertinent points in these films. And I watched the film and I picked up a number of real pertinent points from it. And, you know, the actual need to expand and continue trade meant that at some point in time, ship owners and those that were actually financing what we would term ventures demanded some kind of third-party insurance for the ship or the cargo. And I don't know if there's any fans of Game of Thrones out there, but I'm a big fan. In fact, in one of the episodes, there's a scene where, for those who know the characters, Arya Stark is down on the dock, and she's been enlisted by the God of Many Faces. And basically, they're effectively a gang of assassins. And she's down there to put right the wrongs that no one else can put right. Okay, yeah. That's what the God of Many Faces does. And there's a guy on the dock, and what he's doing is he's actually insuring the ship owners for the eventuality that they don't come back, they don't return.
Well, they're not really going to want to go, are they, if somebody doesn't do that for them, because they'd be taking all the risk on their shoulders.
No, absolutely. And so, of course, you know, you've got the situation where, you know, relating back to the Lloyd's of London as well and Game of Thrones at the same time. I'm going to do it simultaneously.
Yeah.
On the one hand, you know, if you've got a ship owner who's enlisted to go on this venture, and let's say he gets, you know, something happens to the ship, he manages by some fluke to make his way back to Blighty. Without insurance, he's then got the financier and perhaps the guy who employed him in the first place going to effectively be demanding their cash, right? They want their money back for the cargo or the lost profit or so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, the ship owner, you know, he's managed to get back alive, just scraped it, and now he's going to get mullered for owing some money to these guys. On the other hand, if he dies whilst out on his travels, who's going to take care of his family? Now, you know, just to show, I mean, how much does this sound like a typical kind of insurance company? In Game of Thrones, right, there you've got this guy who's been on a number of voyages and he's been successful. He survived. So he goes to the guy on the dock who's effectively the insurer. And in Game of Thrones, this guy looks like a mafia, a kind of local gangster, right? And the ship owner says, look, I've been on all these 5 voyages. I've come back. I survived. I want to go out on this other voyage. Will you take the premium? And the guy, the insurer, goes, no. So, you know, this guy's up, the ship owner's up in arms. He's like, well, who's going to protect my family? And of course, what the insurer wanted was he wanted the ship owners, the voyagers, to go out and fail, right? He wanted them to effectively die, because then he got to keep the premium. And as was said by, you know, Arya Stark's kind of mentor in Game of Thrones, who is going to help the widow get her money from the local gangster?
Yeah.
How's she going to get her payout if her husband's gone, right? So, of course, the insurer didn't want to insure someone that was unlikely to profit him.
Yeah.
Right? And if there was cause for a payout, he wasn't going to pay out. Does that sound familiar?
I've heard of it somewhere before, I'm sure, on occasion, yeah.
So, you know, in essence, you've got, you know, the need to protect the financial interests in the venture as a driving force to then have this thing that we call insurance. Now, with insurance, it links so much into liability. I know when we talk about limited liability, and just to bring up something that I didn't bring up in the DVD, we talk about limited liability. And a lot of the time when we're talking about limited liability companies, people will often think about the shareholders and how once they've paid the price for the share, that is the extent of their liability to the company, right?
Yeah.
However, you know, if we go back to what is sometimes referred to as the first limited liability company, which is the East India Company, right?
Yep.
And you've got Queen Elizabeth, who basically says, look, I'm going to give you royal license or under royal charter, you can go out and do whatever you want, right? But I'm going to limit your liability. In other words, reading between the lines, you go out and do what you want, make a profit, and we'll ask no questions.
Yeah, so there's perhaps a link between limited liability and diminished responsibility, is that?
I would suggest there's a direct link, because, you know, ultimately, when we get to the crux of what insurance kind of, in one sense, what insurance actually does, it kind of, in some respects, it actually kind of removes that personal responsibility and ownership.
Yeah, yes, indeed it does.
You know, it's okay if I cause some customer aggravation, because you know what, they can claim against the insurance and everything will be all right.
Yeah, and sort of by taking out the insurance, you're kind of betting against yourself on a metaphorical level, at least, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And what, you know, well, it's just funny that, you know, the insurance is not going to pay out necessarily if you've done something, if you've been fraudulent, for example. It won't pay out for fraud. I don't know whether it's going to pay out for negligence.
Right? Well, it won't pay out for a fraud that they spot and that is actually defined as a fraud.
Yeah, so maybe it will pay out for some kind of negligence, but you might not be able to get insured again. But, you know, but it does actually remove this whole sense of care and kind of thinking about what you're doing before you do it. So many people will then rush out or kind of have this sense, well, it doesn't matter, I'm protected, you know, put the foot down in the car. Doesn't matter, I've got insurance. Yeah. It's like, well, yeah, you haven't really thought about the consequences if you lose an arm. Mm-hmm. You know, if I was to pay you offer you five grand for your arm, would you accept it?
Yeah.
Probably not.
No, indeed. It's an interesting one, isn't it? I remember when they introduced insurance in Terry Pratchett's fantasy town of Ankh-Morpork. They introduced it. A tourist arrived and told them about it in the local pub. And by the end of the night, the local pub was already in flames. They got the idea, eh? So just as a matter of, so this guy has an idea, he hires a ship owner, then the ship owner goes and finds somebody who's willing to insure him, and he has to pay a premium on the insurance. When all of this started, presumably the money that backed it came from, did it, the Bank of England and the East India Company itself? Where was their starting pile? Because they must have had one.
Well, that's a good question. Obviously, I wasn't there at the time, but if we look at some of the records, I mean, we've got, you know, back in 1688, apparently Lloyd's Coffee House, you know, that's the kind of establishment of Lloyd's Coffee House where the syndicates would meet in order to negotiate some of these insurance contracts. And funnily enough, that's what the film Lloyd's of London is all about. Now, you know, in that film, let's put it this way, there are some pertinent points. I mean, the trade was so important that, you know, there's one scene in the film where a lot of British trade ships to the Azores are being attacked. And, you know, the king effectively needs the trade to continue because the aristocrats and the well-to-dos have become used to their fine wares.
Yeah, right? we know the barons can be trouble, can't they?
And of course, you know, in times of war, you know, come on, I need a cup of tea and stuff like that. You know, that's got to get through. So it was a situation where, you know, ship owners were a little bit loath to travel out. They wanted some kind of military protection. It was a time when, you know, you've got Nelson kicking about and the war's going on. And so there was a bit of a conundrum. The insurers didn't necessarily want to insure the ships, so they wanted to up premiums. But by the same token, you know, ship owners couldn't necessarily afford the premiums, and they're risking their lives. The risk is even greater than it ever was before.
And presumably the insurance companies are having to pay out a lot more often than they did before because they're losing loads of ships at a time and stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you actually had a scene in the film where the king is actually contemplating taking half of Nelson's fleet to protect the trade ships. That's how important the trade was deemed to be. Now, you know, important to who? I mean, presumably important to aristocracy, royalty, and so on and so forth. Perhaps for revenue into the country and so on and so forth. But I would have thought predominantly that, you know, that wealth is going to the merchants. Those who are actually coming up with the ideas and, you know, doing the deals and bringing it in predominantly to sell to the aristocracy, right?
Yeah.
Now, in the film, what's really funny is that, you know, the main character, and I think it was a guy called Jonathan Blake, the main character, he kind of resolves the problem by just selling policies at the old rates, right? So forget the risk, he just sells them at the old rates. And it kind of makes you wonder because there'd been when this first convoy had been hit, you know, there's scenes as if it's like the Wall Street crash. You know, people are like heads in hands. It's like, oh my God, what am I going to do? You know, we've just been hit. We've got all these payouts to do and so on and so forth. And yet here's this guy, the main character of the film, Jonathan Blake, and he's then just issuing, he's like the new kid on the block, and he's just issuing policies at the old premiums. And you think to yourself, well, hold on a second. Where's he going to get the money from if he has to pay out?
Yeah. Good question, Si. Where is he going to get the money from?
Well, I don't know. But
yeah.
What I think is very interesting is that, you know, the members at Lloyd's are called names, aren't they?
Yeah.
And we have names.
Yeah, they're called all sorts of names.
And we have names. And, of course, these names, these members, were ultimately responsible to cover the losses. Now, I know that at Lloyd's, you know, they engage in a lot of reinsurance. Right? And this is going to lead me on to an idea. You've got to remind me at the end of the, or maybe we can talk about it now, I don't know. But I know that at Lloyd's they engage in reinsurance, okay? Now, whether that was happening back in, you know, when the Lloyd's Coffee House or whenever this film was set, the 1800s, or late 1700s, early 1800s, whether or not that was kind of going on back then, I've got no doubt it probably was. You know, who wants a piece of the action? Who wants a piece of this risk? And so on and so forth. I don't know. But it certainly kind of gave me an idea in as much as when we're kind of being pinned down for a liability and it's kind of being, we're being singled out because of the name. That's how we're being kind of identified, right?
Yeah, we're names too.
Yeah. So what if we engaged in reinsurance? Because if I'm not mistaken, an insurance company requires precisely that which anyone who is acting as, say, surety or you know, last resort has the right to see, which is, funnily enough, and this should resonate with a few people out there, proof of claim, proof of loss.
Ah, yep. Well, that should work, because insurance is, in theory, a kind of reflection of the rest of the world, isn't it?
Hmm. But an insurance company, you can't have a car accident and send in a photocopy of a receipt. You've got to send the original in.
Yes.
And they're not going to pay out unless you have had a loss.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least in theory.
Well, if they pay out, yeah, yeah. Of course. So you know, that kind of thing just got me thinking that, well, you know, okay, the name is ultimately responsible, even in accordance with, you know, if you're looking at law of surety and stuff like that, if we are the ultimate surety, and of course the people are the ultimate insurance company, insurer of last resort, if anything goes wrong, don't worry, the people will pay for it, right? Doesn't matter if it's a private business or not. If certain parties decide that it shall be so, then it shall be so, and the taxpayer foots the bill. You know, so up goes national debt.
Because they're assuming a lot of these contracts, and if that presumption isn't kind of rebutted by accepting it, we are effectively underwriting it and we're guaranteeing our own performance. Is that the...
Well, that's just the way that it goes, isn't it? I mean, you know, if you look at what happened with the credit crunch, you know, whatever bailout was required, that, you know, effectively just lumped that onto the national debt. Don't worry, the people will take care of that. So effectively, we are the insurer of last resort. When it comes down to, you know, a liability, albeit the fact that could well be a false liability because of the accounting with whatever company, you know, we're talking about, you know, ultimately we're being held a surety for that name, for that label. And even if that is the case, we still have a right to demand the proof of the claim and the proof of the loss, which of course we're more often than not denied.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, how could we potentially justify demanding those things and be quite legitimate in the eyes of whatever company in asking for that? So I don't know if anyone out there has got a little bit of an entrepreneurial spirit about them, but if, for example, you had an insurer, right, or say a legitimate insurance company, right, effectively reinsuring or insuring all of us for pretty much any eventuality, right, financial, and understanding the game just merely demanded proof of loss, proof of claim, well, there you go. That should kick a lot into touch, right?
Yeah, indeed. And in one of the things I like about that is it's a pretty standard technique, isn't it? That's used to hold a lot of people to account.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, well, because ultimately, in my view, there's a manipulation of the accounts, and double entry accounting is the mechanism by which the game is being played.
Mm. I only recently realised, I know I sent to you in an email a reference to a link we were given last week by Pete Kroll to this stuff on comprehensive annual financial reviews.
And yeah, the councils.
And apparently he says in America it's 54,700 government corporate bodies yielding those reports, and their value is cumulative. So he says it's demonstrating that they actually have $160-odd trillion in the public accounts. And he says that the thing is, what they're doing is they're telling you about a budgetary account and the fact that they can't, you know, complete it or whatever, and they need more money. What they're not telling you about is the total receipts and the investment funds that they're running, and that's the double entry bookkeeping you're talking about, isn't it? It's a whole set of other books that we don't see.
Well, yeah. It is. I mean, well, let's put it this way: what you see is public, what you don't is private. So I was thinking about this. I just had it come to me the other night. You know, we're all divided. What we need is reconciliation. We need a reconciliation of the accounts.
Yeah.
We need to reconcile the accounts, and we need to bring them all together. We need to join them. And once you join them, it's like in Ghostbusters, crossing the beams. Once you join the public and the private, you should find that what's in the private far outweighs the deficit in the public, if not just completely just sets it off anyway.
Yeah, he's saying that most of the pension funds are at least 200% subscribed, and that actually when you look at it, there is so much extra money there that you could mostly get rid of tax, and you could mostly be paying householders, people, you know, who are resident at an address, an amount for being there as well. And of course, wouldn't that change the game if that's the way it worked?
Well, I mean, I heard from I had a friend recently, and I'd seen this. I've heard this from a couple of people actually, that Switzerland were planning to pay the people 1,800 francs. Is it francs they have out in Switzerland?
I think it is.
Swiss francs. They were thinking of paying them 1,800 Swiss francs a month each.
Well, this is the thing. But one of the great things about reading about these reports is that you realise that at least in the terms that there is any kind of cash or money at all, that all of our money is actually there and available, and you can see it as well. He says the reason why it's public is they actually publish these reports, and they send them, they've been sending them for the last 30 years to ABC and NBC and CBS and all of this, but there's a complete agreement amongst the syndicated media never to mention these things. So they are actually in the public realm, apparently, if you go looking.
Well, yeah, and so the question is, how do we get them, if they're in control of the accounts, how do you get them to reconcile and to match it up?
Yeah,
his
argument is that using financial auditors of a certain level, because apparently you need a special qualification to be a council chief financial officer or whatever, and you can only have that qualification if you are a chief financial officer, but retired ones are around, and he said it's possible they have managed to hold some states to account and get them to admit, yes, we have $48 million in an idle investment fund, they call it.
Yeah.
And what he's got is this idea of creating a citizens investment trust account where you leave all of these things in management, because obviously you'd collapse the system if you didn't, but you slowly but surely transfer them back into the public ownership and downsize government. It's a fantastic plan. It's I've got the link here. I'll just put it in, and then we'll get back to the insurance. It's called The Biggest Game in Town, about the government CAFR wealth shell game. And it's a guy called Burial, and it's really great because he has got solutions. He's, you know, and it looks, identifying the money and getting it back into the creditors' hands is a great idea, isn't it?
Yeah. Alternatively, do away with that monetary system, bring in our own monetary system by the people, of the people, for the people, issued by government, and there's no tax.
I think that that's the way it's got to be, because obviously anything that deals with the financial, the way we're creating money at the moment isn't going to work for us.
Yeah. And then, because you think, if you do that, right, if you had that, let's say, perfect world, every country decides to do that, the bankers and what the digits that sit on their computer systems would then become defunct overnight.
Yes.
So it doesn't matter all the fraud they've done, doesn't matter how many digits they've got sitting in the Caymans, doesn't matter.
No.
It's now irrelevant. It's not our digits. That'd we can't
be,
use them.
That'd be really good, because we'd be echoing one of the things they've done several times in my lifetime, which is to get rid of the old currency and replace it with a new one, which leaves anybody who's keeping their money in cash with challenging problems. It would be really great to turn the tables on that, and they've shown it works. So they got it all working from the East India Company, and this must have been back in, what, the 1700s or something like that. And
East India Company brought into being, I've seen different reports, 31st of December, I've sometimes seen 1599, and I've sometimes seen 1600, but it was Queen Elizabeth that gave them the Royal Charter, so.
Blimey, so that was, wow, that's actually quite early on in the development of this system then, sort of a good 60 years before the Great Fire of London.
Yeah.
But what happened eventually, because insurance started working presumably first of all for all these ships and all of that, and then they started extending it to other things, but it did end up, according to your DVD, with the great and good actually insuring their peasants, killing them and then trousering the cash, which sounds a bit grotesque. Was there a lot of that going on, was there?
Well, let's put it this way. I mean, when you look at government and a lot of the things that are around us today, even systems of law and stuff, you can see how trade is, or how the ideas picked up in trade have actually driven a lot of what we've got working around us at the moment, right? But at some point in time, you know, consider that you're, or imagine that you're an aristocrat. You've got money, you've got women, you've got as much booze as you want, you've got all the land you could ever need. How are you going to get your kicks? Well, you know, one way was kind of gambling. But of course, you know, like most gamblers, they like to win. So how can you kind of have a guaranteed win? Well, what you do is you take out an insurance policy on some local peasant, right? And life insurance policy, and you kill him.
Yes.
And you collect. Now, we learned about this when I was studying for FPC, Financial Planning Certificate. This was in the course, you know, we learned about this. It's called insurable interest, because the way that the market actually stamped that out was to require that if you're going to insure somebody, you've got to have some kind of interest in them.
Yeah.
You can't just go, you know, because otherwise, you know, you get that scenario. You pick on someone, okay, and this was mirrored in the film Lloyd's of London. You know, in the film, you've got the star of the show, Jonathan Blake. He's sitting at Lloyd's of London in the coffee house, and in comes this old fella who must have been about 90 years old, right? And he's heard that this Jonathan Blake has accepted some kind of insurance contract on him, right? Life insurance contract on him. And the old fella comes into the coffee house and he's spitting blood. You know, how dare you gamble on my life, right? He said, I have heard that if I die before 12 noon today, you're going to make money on me or something. So, you know, he said, I've come down here, I've got out of my sick bed just to make damn sure that you're not going to do it, right? You're not going to make money off my back. Anyway, the old fellow had worked himself up into such a stupor that he has a heart attack and dies, and Jonathan Blake wins the bet. So but the point is that, you know, that kind of thing that we call insurable interest, which is going to feed quite neatly into, you know, where I know this conversation is going, i.e. with regards to Walmart and you know, and employees. You know, to what kind of interest is it, any interest that can be insured?
Let's have a look at the Walmart story, and then we'll have a look at one or two of the other things you bring up in the DVD, because this will show how important the subject is. It's you mentioned it on the DVD, but I've fished out a couple of links, as I told you earlier. I'll just post the first one into the chat book from theconsumerist.com, and it's entitled "Walmart Took Secret Life Insurance Policies Out on Employees Collected After Their Death." And this is what it says. One of the paragraphs says, according to the lawsuit, the policies were for $50,000 to $80,000. And were taken out, and we'll hear contradictory evidence on that in a bit, and were taken out on any employee from 18 to 70 who participated in Walmart's health plan. Walmart stopped taking out the policies in 1995, it says, but continued collecting the money on employees and ex-employees who passed away. Where's the moral high ground there? Walmart cancelled the policies altogether in 2000. And then it says, according to Court TV, only six states, Delaware, Georgia, New Jersey, North Carolina, Pennsylvania and Vermont, allow companies to take out life insurance policies on their employees without notifying them. First of all, I was interested that this only happened to people who had their health plan with Walmart. Because effectively, it seems to mean that they could be worth more to the company dead than alive, doesn't it? There's got to be a...
Well, I mean, I know that with most employers, you know, they will often offer you life insurance, which you can then dictate who the beneficiary is going to be. So, for example, that's usually linked into, you know, it's usually one of the benefits. And it might be linked into the pension plan, you know, if they offer one, right? Yeah. And I think it was usually four times your salary or something like that. That's from memory, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The old FPC study. Mm. I remember reading, I was down in Glastonbury, funnily enough, a good few years back, when I read that story in a cafe prior to doing a seminar one Saturday. And the figure I'd read in there, you know, that I don't know if it's the same story, but the figure I'd read was like in the paper, $1.5 million. And this guy that, you know, had passed away, and his wife and kids got nothing, and Walmart walked off with his money. And the only way that I can fathom that they were kind of doing this or to justify it was with what was called key man insurance. In other words, it was an insurance that if you had like a star player working for your company, say, you know, top sales manager.
Yeah.
And if he's, you know, there's not many of that kind of ilk around. And so you would insure him so that if anything happened to him, the company was covered for the period of time that it was going to take to replace him. Yeah. Right. And so that was called key man. I mean, obviously key, Q-U-A-Y.
Nice, sorry, yeah, Q-E-Y. Yeah, like that.
You know, so if I can actually get, you know, get my tongue together. So, you know, I was thinking to myself, when I heard that story, I'm thinking, well, hold on, how do these people, how are they going to work that out? And I kind of thought, well, okay, maybe in terms of insurable interest, Maybe the company was going to justify it from the basis of, you know, let's take the turnover, let's divvy it up between the numbers of staff, and then you've got a rough amount that each member of staff is could potentially be considered to have contributed to the company, you know, the turnover.
Nice use of statistics.
Hmm. But that leaves
you with sort of 800 odd grand in pounds and about $1.5 million. Ahead at that point.
Yeah, well, I kind of worked out similar figures on Sainsbury's, and it kind of worked out to that amount.
Yeah.
So I thought that was, you know, it worked out to about 800,000 in pounds, and I thought, well, okay, roughly, you know, 1.6 times or whatever it is to get it into the dollar a couple of years back.
Yeah.
And so it kind of...
yeah, quite. Yeah, should we take comfort from the fact that only six states allow companies to take out life insurance policies on their employees without notifying them? Do we think that's even likely to be correct?
Would we even know if the employers were doing it? You know, I wonder.
Yeah. I mean, they may disguise it as loss of revenue or All sorts of different things.
Absolutely. I mean, if there's stuff going on behind the scenes, how can you honestly know? I mean, nothing kind of surprises me nowadays. Having, you know, investigated some of these things for the last 8 years, nothing surprises me kind of anymore. You know, it's so it would not surprise me, albeit the fact that a policy or a rule comes out, that doesn't necessarily mean that everyone's complying with it.
No, certainly not in our experience, I'd say. And I agree with you. I mean, the discovery of these financial reports and all the funds behind them and stuff like that came as a real surprise to me. And as you know, I've been at this game intensely now for 6 or 7 years. And it is amazing how no matter how much you learn, there is always a bigger shock just round the corner until you do become kind of numb. And all it does is it makes you chuckle, doesn't it, really? I think the Walmart one, though, is such a chilling example. It goes on to say further in the Consumerist article, it says Armatrout was one of 350,000 employees that Walmart secretly insured nationwide, said Texas Attorney Michael D. Myers, who estimated, interestingly, the company collected on 75 to 100 policies involving Florida employees. So they reckon they collected on 75 to 100 of 350,000 of these policies. But interestingly, and this is the chilling one from the Walmart Sucks blog, where somebody's writing whose husband actually had money taken, and as you said, Si, the family got nothing. And this blog says, last spring, my attorneys told me that Walmart had a secret life insurance policy on my husband with Hartford Insurance to the amount of $300,000, which they had collected shortly after my husband died. In 1993 to 94, Walmart took out 350,000 secret life insurance policies on low-level employees who also had their health insurance with them. They called these policies dead peasant policies or dead janitor policies. So some things never go away, eh?
No. Nice. I wonder which insurance company was accepting those.
Yeah.
Mm. They name Hartford Insurance in here, but this is... Yeah, this apparently stopped in the year 2000, so they say. But, I mean, my impression from what you're saying on the DVD is that actually there's an enormous number of people who might be deemed to have an insurable interest in us.
Well, I took great joy in going down to Asda's. Well, when I popped into Asda's every now and then, I took great joy in telling the cashiers, you know, that they were most likely insured. And one of them actually said, yeah, we are.
Yeah.
So... certainly members of staff over here working in Asda's seem to be under the impression that as part of the Walmart family, they are insured.
So what about this theory that our national insurance number is actually an employee number, making us the employees of the state, at least in theory? Does that perhaps give them an insurable interest over us?
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? I mean, you know, look at it this way. If you've got someone in a contract, anyone in a contract, do you have, and they've got to pay you money, do you now have an interest in them? You do. You've got a financial interest in them.
Yeah.
Right? So whether it's the tax man, it wouldn't surprise me one iota if the tax man could actually insure that interest if they've got an expectant amount to come from you. It wouldn't surprise me. In fact, we know this to be so. You know, banks, if you've got a mortgage, if you've got a loan, the bank can insure that.
Yeah.
They can not only hedge their bets, on the markets to actually cover for any eventuality, but they can also insure that loss or that potential loss or that interest.
Yeah, and they not only do that, they often insist that you take out insurance.
Mm.
So that if at some point you can't pay your mortgage payment or you die, that their debt, as it were, is covered.
No, absolutely. And in fact, on commercial deals as well, they may well dictate. I mean, you think of the mortgage indemnity guarantee. You pay for that premium, right? Mm. You pay for that, and they are the beneficiary, and they hold the policy.
Yeah, and at the end of the policy, you are supposed to get the money back. All the premiums you've paid out, you're supposed to get back. But how many people do?
Yeah, exactly.
And the loan note.
Well, and the loan note, yeah, absolutely. Well, in fact, I tell you what, on the mortgage front, there's something we'll leave it towards the latter part, but, you know, that getting the note, not the note, but getting the mortgage back, just happens to be feed into one remedy that's been proven to work with regards to reducing a mortgage capital balance.
Excellent. Well, we will have a look at that before the end of the show, I think. And one of the things that's concerning me about this is, say you buy yourself a house, or, you know, you get out the loan and you get the house and you do lots of work in it and you make the garden really nice and all of that, and maybe put a granny flat on it, and you keep paying your mortgage and things like that. And obviously, as time goes by, the value of the house goes up, or the value of the currency goes down, whichever it is that's happening. And there must come a point when the bank or whoever the mortgagor is can look at it and think, do you know what? I'd make much more if this person fails in some mm-hmm. way, fails to pay or dies or doesn't complete on the contract.
Yeah.
And if they've got an insurance on you, doesn't that surely another epidemic of conflicts of interest by the sound of it?
Well, yeah, because, well, I mean, this is the way I look at an insurance contract, right? And I think on the DVD I gave an example. So let's say that I go down to the betting office and I say to the bookmaker, I say, right, I bet 100 quid that my wife is going to die within the next 10 years, right?
Yeah.
And I say, have a look at her. What do you reckon?
Yeah.
What odds will you give me, right? So they maybe give me, I don't know, what is it?
100 to 1.
100 to 1,
yeah.
Right? Or 1,000 to 1, right? 1,000 to 1. So I've got 100 quid, so it's going to be 100 grand.
Okay, if she pegs it in 10 years, yeah.
So if she dies within the next 10 years, I win £100,000, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what is the difference than if that bookmaker was suddenly an insurance broker and I go down and say, right, we want to insure the wife, her life, for 100,000. So if she dies, you know, I get £100,000. What's the premium going to be?
Yeah.
What's the difference?
No difference. So the guys in your Lloyd's of London film, who have basically got this amazing card index system on which they're monitoring where ships turn up, aren't they? That's what they're doing. And they're kind of basically what they're doing is betting on whether they're going to turn up or not.
Of course, it's a gamble. it's a gamble. Don't get me wrong, when we're talking about things like life assurance and stuff like that, you know, they've got their actuaries, so they're really going into the minutiae as to, you know, what's the actuarial likelihood of something happening, right? So, you know, they're really going into it, and that in itself is potentially a science. But, you know, look, who runs the gambling rings?
The people with the most amount of money, I would have thought.
Well, typically, if you watch the films, in films, who runs the gambling rings? Who runs the casinos?
Mostly the mafia, yeah.
Oh, the mafiosa, right. Yeah. So, you know, look, it's just another one of these, you know, it's just part of the game, and it's just part of the overall casino that we're playing in. You know, you go into a casino, and you hand over your money, and you change it for their worthless chips, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Currency now, exchange, mate.
Well, so, well, just as a side caveat, anyone who watches the first episode of The Ascent of Money, BBC, okay, check out for the little section about the Medicis, who suddenly realised that loaning money was not as profitable as currency exchange. And I thought to myself, you're having a laugh, right? Unless that currency exchange is handing over money of substance for their worthless chips. And I think they ran Florence from memory. So you would go to Florence and you would pass around their worthless currency, but you would have to exchange gold for their worthless currency, right? Now, I've got no doubt that currency exchange is very, very lucrative when you do it in that kind of way, right? Because while you're in Florence, you know, you pass it, you know, I've got the use of the gold if I'm one of the Medicis. But anyway, so you go into the casino, you've exchanged your, you know, your proper currency for their worthless chips. You may or may not then have a gamble with it, and you may win, you may lose, all right? But in gambling, you're also playing, you know, so the casino's run by the mafia or the mafiosa, and, you know, when you go onto your gamble or your insurance gambling, then again, that game, another part of the game, is also run by those that are running the casino.
Yeah,
it's just another, it's just a different mafia. Yeah, it's just a different gang.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing, isn't it? And as you said, it's not money that makes the world go around, it's insurance.
It's insurance because the trade ships, historically, trade ships, you know, they did not want to set sail unless there was some kind of third-party insurance in place. They had to make sure that from the ship owner's point of view or the captain's point of view, he wants his wife and kids to be all right if he doesn't make it back. He's risking life and limb. And the guys that have actually got the money invested in the cargo and the venture, well, obviously they've got an insurable interest in that, you know, and getting their profit out. So they want the cargo protected.
Yeah. So the companies are effectively kind of, they're tempting. I like your point which I think is quite a subtle one, that they're sort of tempting fate by insuring against us surviving or succeeding or repaying or whatever. Because they insure everything, don't they? There isn't an aspect of human endeavour that doesn't deal with insurance companies. And they stand to make much more than we might otherwise have expected from us not succeeding in the policy. But the thing that really interests me about that is that they're actually tempting fate. They're changing the potential path of reality by doing this sort of stuff and writing it all down and not realising, or maybe they do realise, that the words and feelings have got resonance. Mm. And that applies also, as you said, to us, because we become less responsible if we feel that if we burn it down, we can just have it back.
Yeah, well, on the one aspect, if you subscribe to the idea that we are all resonance, right, and it's pretty much a scientific fact, but if you ultimately you are tempting fate. What if somebody is, as you said earlier, Doc, what if someone's going to gain from your demise, right? So they're willing you to fail.
Yeah.
They're willing you to fail.
And by taking out the insurance, you're acknowledging the risk as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, is it beyond the realms of possibility that they might put into play things that would help you fail if they stand to win?
Mm.
Right, that's not beyond the realms of possibility, right? I mean, I'm sure that's happened on more than one occasion, right? So you've got, it's typically called an insurance job, right?
Yeah.
So you've got that aspect to all of it, for a start. The other aspect is the fact that when we talk about companies and members of staff, especially nowadays in our modern world where members of staff are going around and doing things and not necessarily giving a damn why they're doing it, they don't ask questions why they're doing it. In fact, recent study, more than two-thirds of staff are not confident that they even know what they're doing in their jobs.
Mm.
Two-thirds, right? Yeah. I think that must have been a survey of public servants. I'm not sure, but anyway.
No, it'll be far more than that.
So are they covered by their limited liability insurance if they're not obeying their own rules?
Well, this is the point. The member of staff will probably think so. Whether or not they are depends on what they've done. I mean, if they've stepped outside of their remit, then depending on what they've done, really, they should not be insured. That should become a liability that's firmly in the pockets, or going to dent the pockets of the member of staff. Now, whether or not the company, depending on what's happened and how it all plays itself out, sometimes I've got no doubt that the company would accept liability for it. Other times it's not that straightforward. Let me give you an example, right? Obviously, there's a lot of people out there, you should know that I used to work in banking. Now, I worked for one bank, and I'm going to name it Standard Chartered Bank, right? I worked for a subsidiary of Standard Chartered Bank. And you'd think, wow, Standard. They must have standards. It's in the title, right? Now, when I was working there, we did lending.
It was very low
standards. It was very low standards. They employed me for a start. But anyway, so they...
That was the only time their standards went up.
Yeah, I agree. Hear.
Well, look, we used to lend money.
There must have been some sort of horrible mistake, son.
So we loaned money and we had to collect it back, right? And I can remember there was, as it got towards the end of the month, that's when our accounting period was, we would chase up customers because we wanted to make sure they were going to pay, right? And the aim of the game with all the customers that were in arrear was you had to collect a payment to get them off of your collection sheets, right? Which is basically a sheet of paper with a list of names and balances, right? That was your collection sheet. You got to get these people to pay, right? So one of the guys there had this, one of his accounts that he was looking after was a fairly big account, and the customer sent in a check unsigned. Now, when you get a check through, if it's undated, you can date it. If it hasn't got the payee written in there, you can write the payee in if it's arrived at your company, because it's reasonably intended to come to you. So you can do that. But what you're not allowed to do is, if the customer hasn't signed it, you can't sign their check for them.
Has anyone told the banks that?
Well, they're supposed to know this. But anyway, one of the guys, he decided that he was going to help the customer out and sign the check for them, right? Now, obviously, this was a ploy that a lot of what we called delinquent customers would employ, because they would send the check along. They knew damn well that that could never be cashed or shouldn't be cashed. And of course, they just sent it along with the old, oh, doll, sorry, I forgot to sign it.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, that got banked. It got cleared. Customer went mental, right? Absolutely ballistic.
Who'd have thought it? I wonder why.
Well,
bloody customers.
They went mental because they knew they hadn't signed it. Anyway,
yeah,
the proverbial hit the fan, and the bank who, you know, this guy, let's put it this way, the area manager was the old branch manager. So the area manager and the branch manager both wanted to keep it under wraps. So the bank wiped off that account because the area manager could approve it.
Wow. So the bank just paid him off.
The bank took the hit, yeah. Right? I mean, not much of a hit when you understand how all the loans work, but the bank took the hit. The customer was kind of went away happy. But the main thing was the member of staff didn't get reported to the police, right?
Mm.
Now, change that. Another example, HFC Bank, Household Finance Corporation, now owned by HSBC. While I was working there in an alternate branch, a branch manager had been allowing or giving the cashier his password in order to do various things, right? And well, you know, it happened, man. We know we used to do it with staff that you could trust. But anyway, he obviously thought he could trust her. She kind of let him down because what she was doing was she was reactivating dormant accounts, withdrawing money from these dormant accounts, and then making them dormant again, right? It's just a screen. It's just a little tick box that you had on a certain screen on the customer's account. So she was using his password, and she got away with about 70 grand before getting caught.
Wow.
Right. The bank did not cover that one. He got the boot. She got prosecuted. Now, the thing is, you know, really, what's the difference? Well, the difference is because, you know, the people that were involved, maybe the amount involved, the area manager could cover the one at Standard Chartered. He couldn't cover the other one, you know, maybe because of the amount involved. Maybe the face didn't fit. Who knows what the reasons were? They perhaps both should have been prosecuted for fraud, right? But they weren't. Okay, and I've seen the kind of deals that get done in the bank where the bank is prepared to take the hit for the wrongdoing of the member of staff. But technically speaking, the member of staff really should have foot the bill, but you can pretty much bet your bottom dollar that the insurance wouldn't have paid out.
Well, it's a very shadowy line, isn't it? Because if the entire system and its apparent money is actually a fraud, you're going to have a bit of a difficulty deciding who you're going to go for and who you're going to leave alone.
Hmm. Well, you are. Of course you are. But the main thing is those members of staff had done things which would not have enabled, had that gone to court, say the bank had stood their ground and so on and so forth, you get a court case results from it and the bank then has to pay out. There's no way that the insurance would have paid out on that, right? Because it was for fraud in both cases, right? Yeah. So the bank had to take the hit. But technically speaking, the members of staff should have taken the hit. And so I think, you know, what you've got is you've got a mentality that seems to have been created within members of staff where they seem to think, you know, or even people take out, you know, set up a limited liability company and think, yeah, I can pretty much do what I like because, you know, if the company folds, well, the liability is left with the company. Well, yes, it is, but not always. It depends what you've done as a director, right? It depends what you've been up to because there are a number of circumstances where the director's personal assets can be brought in to cover liabilities of the company, right? Pretty powerful stuff when you get into some of the actual company law, right? But the essence or the actual issue is with the lower members of staff who just seem to think that they can do what they want and it doesn't matter because, you know, we've got insurance.
Mm.
Now, you know, there's something that I wanted to touch on at some point in time, which was with regards to the film Fight Club.
I love that film. I really didn't expect to enjoy it, but I thought it was brilliant. Really brilliant.
Blinding film. And Ed Norton, right? Ed Norton. It's a different aspect. I mean, it's looking at risk, right? But it just kind of looks at the, you know, the thing that I wanted to bring up was really the kind of ruthless decision-making process that's employed by some companies. Because in that film, if I'm getting my films correct, Ed Norton was kind of like a risk assessor for a motor car company, I think, or some kind of insurance assessment guy, right?
Yeah.
And he made comment, he was talking about how if there was a flaw with a car, for example, so I know in the press recently there was some Vauxhall Astra which went up in flames for some reason, but I'm not saying...
Vauxhall Sphere, isn't
it? Was a Vauxhall Sphere, right, yeah. Lovely. So Vauxhall Sphere has gone up in flames. But let's say, for example, you've got a series of cars that have been produced and there's a fault, right? So Ed Norton's explaining in Fight Club that what will happen is the company will draft in some actuary, and they'll do a risk assessment, and they'll look at, well, what's the likelihood, you know, what likelihood is there of cars, how many cars are going to go up in flames, right? What you know, what's the rough number that we think is going to go up in flames? And of those that go up in flames, how many people are going to be in the car when the car goes up in flames and explodes, right? For no apparent reason. And what they'll do is they'll then work out, well, what's the likely claim going to be from those families or the people that managed to survive? What are the likely damages that we're going to have to pay out, right?
And what do they use? They use a crystal ball or a tarot pack or something for sorting this out?
Or some dice, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, so this is the insurer on behalf of the company is then looking at, well, okay, so how much are we likely to pay out on court cases and this, that, and the other? And if that figure is less than than doing nothing, right? Because obviously they're weighing up, do they do a recall?
Yeah.
So if the figure on payout is less than the profitability by just doing nothing, then they'll just do nothing. But the point is, well, which 50 or 60 or 100 people are going to be biting the bullet?
Yeah.
And would the MD of that company like to volunteer to be the first?
Well, we like that. That's why I like the question. I can't remember. I think I got it off Rob Sproul to start with, which is, are you accepting liability in your private capacity for the claims stroke decisions that you're making here today?
Nice question.
Yeah. Because we're operating in a state of unlimited liability all the time, and especially if we're not careful.
Yeah, for all intents and purposes, which is why I kind of, you know, brought up that thing about having a company to reinsure us, or maybe we could all reinsure each other, because, you know, effectively, well, let's put it this way. Myself and Mark met with this ex-high-level banker going back a couple of weeks, right? And he was talking to us about mortgages, giving us some inside knowledge on mortgage products. And he was basically saying that he was a trader at one point, and he was saying, he was explaining how he had effectively like the bond paper for lots and lots of different big companies, and he could write prom notes for all of them, right? And then he was explaining that, you know, if they were doing certain trades, there would be auditors that would come round, and it could well be a case whereby, you know, he's done a trade, he's been left short on stock, and he needs to borrow some stock, right, from one of his mates just to balance his book. And it became quite clear that as long as your book's balanced when the auditor comes round, that's fine. But just because the auditor's in your firm checking your book, how do you know that everybody else's book is balanced?
Well, right? Presumably you know when the auditors are coming. I mean, I'm deeply suspicious of the auditors.
Well, certainly if you work for government, they'll give you advance notice they're coming, right?
Yeah.
So you can get your paperwork in order, right?
We always knew when they were coming, you know.
Well, you know, I must admit, internal auditors when I was at the banks, they didn't tell you. They turned up.
Yeah.
And they just turned up. I mean, you know. But obviously in some of these places, these people are being given advance warning. Now, in essence, what he was then effectively describing was that, you know, you've got, it's kind of past the hot potato, you know, or it's like musical chairs. So the shortfall is just, as long as the shortfall is keeping ahead of the auditor, everything is tickety-boo. As long as the auditor doesn't catch up with the shortfall in the account.
That's a bit like chasing the liability around the court system, isn't it, that?
Absolutely, but it's also like pass the liability around, right? So, if I reinsure you and so-and-so reinsures me and it's, you know, I accept his liability. No, he accepts my liability. And it's just like, right, okay. And you could potentially have, I mean, it could be quite funny. You could have a scenario where, you know, you're effectively sending a company with a claim onto however many umpteen 100 other companies or other parties to go and collect, right? But it would be, you know, certainly if there was some way of setting up an insurance company which provided insurance, could potentially even take premiums to cover the, you know, a one-off premium to cover the admin.
Yeah. But it is something I'd like to talk with. I think we should probably have a musical break. We've got a couple of questions. We've got some quite interesting left-field questions from the chat box, which we might go through first. But I would like to chat about the a bit more about insurance after the break and a bit about some of the ways that we might find of working around it, because clearly it would be in our interest to do so. It doesn't seem to be doing anything like as much good as it is causing us harm to me, like so many other things. So you've been listening to me chatting with Mark Moxham and Simon Spaniard from youandyourcash.com, which is a fabulous website with great videos on it, and they're still being added to, I notice. And this is Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com, despite what I accidentally said earlier on. still on, you know, it was bound to happen sooner or later, that was. And because I think it's vaguely applicable, we've got about 6 or 7 minutes of music, and we're going to kick off with Alligators Getting Up from the Curve, because aren't they just? And we'll be back with you in 7 or 8 minutes. Thanks, gentlemen. Yay, CC Smugglers there, and Good Day from a little EP that's called Write What You Know. Very sound piece of advice, don't you think, Si?
Yeah, you have to excuse me, I'm just having a cigarette while we're doing this chat. Yeah.
Seems to be a lot of that goes on the radio. Great.
And I've sent Mark out to make a cup of tea, so...
Brilliant.
So you got me on my own at the moment.
So you were... we were just chatting in the break about the suggestion that it's your understanding that, as well as costing us an enormous amount of money and funneling loads of money off it and maybe claiming thing off dead people and stuff like that, that they actually don't have any money to settle the claims. So how does that work?
Well, you know, look, I've heard a number of things, and obviously I haven't seen it firsthand because I don't have access to the insurance company's books or the bank's books who have the accounts of the insurance companies. But, you know, it kind of makes sense when you start thinking of bills of exchange and what does constitute cash and what instruments could be used just to draw down on a rolling banking, for want of a better word, overdraft, let's say, right? Let's say a real big, very large, flexible overdraft, right, which only needs to be used when it's claimed upon. Think about it. The insurance company, which in theory... You know, all reinsurers are supposed to, at the very foundation of the insurance industry, are supposed to have deposits of capital which are not with banks but with other reinsurers. Now that's quite convenient as far as I'm concerned.
So how do you decide where the money stops? That's a bit of a...
Well, look, you know, as far as I'm concerned, banking and insurance, it's a match made in heaven. And if I had a bank and an insurance company, I think, you know, making money would be absolutely no problem whatsoever. Right? Yeah, well,
a lot of people may not realize that AXA Insurance actually owns a bank. It runs its own bank.
Well, there you go. So,
oh, my God.
You know, so ultimately, you know, these are, you know, that's what commerce is all about. Bank, you know, it's banking and insurance.
Yeah.
So ultimately... You know, I've heard that certainly with regards to car insurance, some of the car insurers, they only have to lodge, I think it's a £40,000 bond with a DVLA, right, to cover, in effect, their liability on accident claims, right?
40,000?
Yeah, right.
I was just wondering, how does that cover it? They must be reinsured. It's as simple as that.
Now, the thing is, I mean, if you go onto an insurance company's website, you'll typically find that they are very, very... boastful about the amount of liability that they actually have on risk, because it's usually very, very large amounts, and large amounts make it immediately, you know, gives the impression that you're dealing with a massively large company, right? I mean, they must be. If they're insuring 20 trillion amount of risk, they must have 20 trillion in the bank, right? Well, not necessarily, because, you know, a claim, if you're lodging a claim, you're making a claim against someone and you're directing them to pay money, right, either to you or to somebody else. Well, that's a bill of exchange.
So it's going to have a place of origin, a signature and a date.
And it's treated as cash.
And a value.
And it's treated as cash for accounting purposes.
So as ever, we're providing the money that sorts the claim.
Well, let's put it this way. If you wanted to max out on profits, what would you do? Mm. And you controlled the game.
Ah. And then there's the point, I don't know whether you've heard this, but looking into motor insurance, apparently only something like 0.1% of policies are ever claimed on.
Really?
Apparently so. It's really small. Really, really small.
Well,
so,
I know that on PPI, only 1 in 100 claims that are made are paid out on.
Really?
So that was the lowest. That's what was such a con with payment protection insurance, in as much as... But, you know, the actual payout ratio was so small. It was just, it was ridiculous. They just, I mean, we know stereotypically insurance companies stereotypically try to find ways to not pay out.
Yeah.
That's right? That's the biggest part that their staff are used to facilitate.
To obstruct. Yeah. Yeah. To obstruct, to distract, push you away. Plus, of course, you know, if you're making an insurance contract, right, set amount, for an eventuality, Why is it that they then downsell you, especially car accidents, they then downsell you and say, well, the car's not worth that now. But your contracted amount, let's say your contracted amount was for $2,000. You have the accident and they say, well, the car's not worth that. Now it's a write-off. We'll give you £900.
Mm. Isn't that endeavouring to renegotiate the contract?
Well, absolutely. So where's the 1,100? Where's the extra 1,100 go? Mm. Who has that? Now, could it be, right, could it be that the insurance company pockets the 1,100 and gives you the,
yeah,
and gives you the 900?
Yeah.
Mm. Absolutely. Why not?
I would expect them to do that. I mean, it's not like they're being honest all the way down the line in any other way.
I try to put myself in the shoes of, you know, what kind of underhand things could you do to actually get the money out, whether it's just false accounting. I mean, we know that some of these parties are not averse to false accounting. We know that creative account, that's what it's called, creative accounting. We know that that's a, you know, very big with lots of these places. But if you think about the claim form, if the claim form is being treated as cash for accounting purposes, or alternatively is used to actually then draw down and justify with a bank, for example, let's say that that's deposited then with a bank, and that enables the bank then to actually then draw down on an open-ended facility and create more money, right?
Yeah.
So how does claiming benefits work?
Wow, all the same thing again.
It's the same difference. Mm. Now, how is it that in different parts of the country, parties claiming the same benefit get different amounts? Could it be that that's what they've opted for? And if there's a set amount that each of these kind of signatures is worth, I mean, we know potentially they're worth unlimited, right? Yeah. But let's say that the industries police themselves and they kind of set, you know, even in the honor amongst thieves, let's take that as the standing point. So honor amongst thieves, they agree amongst themselves that there's a set amount, a set value for each signature, right?
Yeah.
And so what they do is then, it's then a free fall. It's then a case of, well, how good a salesman are you? If you can get someone to accept, you know, X amount, you keep the difference.
Yeah.
And no one knows because it's honor amongst thieves, right? Not, it's a nod and a wink.
Let him who will be deceived be deceived.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, even in the selling of insurance policies, there is a sliding scale.
Yeah.
You know, if you go outside, if, for instance, AXA, I'll use them again, they use a lot of brokers, you know, to sell policies to the public. And those brokers, if they're not specified AXA brokers, they can charge whatever they like.
Yep. Yep. I'm aware of that practice.
You know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, are they honest? No. Do they work together? Yes. I mean, a friend of mine had a hideous accident some years ago now, and we knew somebody locally who worked for the insurance company, and they said, whatever you do, don't go into the insurance company with your claim without getting legal representation, because the two insurance companies, the one you're insured with and the one that the person who caused the accident is insured with, will work together to give you the minimum payout.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had heard that. I'd also heard that some insurance companies actually have run two sets of garages, you know, one for the one that has ended up as being deemed to have caused the accident and another one for the ones that didn't. And the one that does all the repair works, and they both kind of got contracts with paint manufacturers and things like that. So there's all sorts of stuff behind the insurance tying you into a whole load of contracts that you know nothing about at all.
Yeah. Yep.
What about this business in the, you know, in the financial world of people shorting all manner of things? Because effectively what they're doing is insuring against their own cock-ups, isn't it? It's always looked that way to me.
Well, yeah. Well, in fact, and probably the best film, if people haven't seen it, is The Big Short.
Yeah.
Fantastic film, right? And even explains everything. I love it. I love the film. It explains everything as you go.
And it's very funny, too, I think. I laughed
a lot. Very funny. Very funny. Loads of, you know, it's got some brilliant actors in there. You've got loads of star names in there. I mean, how that's not been, you know, I've not really seen that promoted too much, and I wonder why. but if you watch that film, and also Inside, I think it's Inside Job with Matt Damon, right?
Yeah, that's great.
And
too.
That's the one where he then reveals that, you know, when the world economy almost collapsed, 2007, 2008. And I think it was JP Morgan. Well, certainly they were one of the players. When their mortgage portfolio went bad, they'd actually gambled against the performance of their mortgage portfolio, so they won. Now, what is it? I mean, okay, you know, look, I can understand it from one point of view, that you're hedging your bet, right? But you kind of have to raise the question, well, okay, we know there's ifs and buts, anything can happen, right? Anything can happen. But then again, they've got their actuaries, they've got their experience. I mean, I thought this is what's supposed to make them so wise in financial matters.
Because supposedly paying for.
Well, yeah, because of their experience, right, and their knowledge. So why would they need, why would they have any doubts as to the performance and the likely performance of a mortgage portfolio which they themselves have approved?
Assuming they had those doubts, which seems, you know, they're bound to have had doubts about the mortgages they were selling, aren't they?
Well, yeah, well, because, you know, as was explained in the films, what the banks were basically doing was they were packaging these things up, you know, into these SPVs, all right? And the bank was really effectively just picking up a commission. So they were writing the business, picking up a commission, but it was almost a case of, but it doesn't really matter because it's not really ours.
Selling it on. And letting people who couldn't possibly afford it take out mortgages. So when they took out that, what I'm suggesting is that when they took out that insurance or that short position or whatever it was, they must have known they were going to win that way.
Well, I've got no doubt, man. I mean, let's put it this way. You know, you're talking to an ex-mortgage broker, right? Now, in the film, The Big Short, there's actually a scene where, what's his name? It was the guy that was Batman. I can't remember his name either. So one of these guys goes down to visit these two brokers because he's just finding out, he's doing some research and he's beginning to ascertain that, hold on, there's a problem with the mortgage market, right? And he goes down to see these brokers, and these brokers are kind of boasting and they're joking and they're laughing about how quickly they can get deals through and how they can effectively get a deal through for basically anyone. And they're laughing about it, right? Now, you know, don't get me wrong. In many respects, I've been there, right? I've been there where I've been in meetings with other brokers, and we would just be looking at this. Having worked for a bank where you had to collect, if your underwriting was poor, you had to go out and knock on the door of the customer to collect the money, right? So in other words, if I wrote a bad loan, it was me knocking on the customer's door at 8 o'clock at night to collect it back. In other words, you tried your best not to write bad loans, right? That's with the old eyes. So I know it's all bollocks, you know, for want of a different word, but at the end of the day, with that old head on and those old eyes, you know, I would do my utmost to write loans where the customer was going to pay you back, right? Because I didn't want to be traipsing around knocking on doors, right? I didn't want to do that. But as a broker, you didn't have to collect what you wrote because that was passed on to somebody else. That's someone else's problem.
You sell it on, package it up and sell it on.
Absolutely. All we had to do was write business. Now, the funny thing was, you know, I've been there, right? I've been in a meeting with a bank representative, numerous bank representatives, when they have said, look, at the end of the day, we can self-declare anything up to £40,000, right? So if a customer is earning up to £40,000, you only need to get them to sign this piece of paper. If they're earning £40,001, they're going to need to prove it. Now, when we used to package the deals, so if you can imagine, as a broker, we do a lot of the legwork. So we're finding the customers, we're selling the deal, and then we're collecting all the paperworking from the customer. Yeah, Christian Bale, but I actually got the wrong character in the film. It wasn't Christian Bale that I was after, but that was the name I was after. He was the Batman guy. But anyway, so imagine the broker, right? So the broker's sold the deal. They found a customer. The customer wants to go ahead. You sell the deal. They're happy. You collect all the paperwork from the customer. You package it up in a nice order with a lovely tick sheet that the bank's provided you with so that the bank has got everything that they want. And then you send it off to the bank and the bank staff are processing it through and they're making sure that, you know, where we've ticked it off against criteria, they're going to tick it off against criteria. They might have one or two underwriting questions. But how would you feel if all of a sudden a member of bank staff comes back and says, there's a problem with income. Has the customer got an additional job they forgot about? Now, that was code for go back to the customer and find him an additional job that he forgot about.
Right.
Do you get me?
Yeah, that really is creative accounting.
Now, this was the bank telling the broker. Now, don't get me wrong. They didn't tell you out and out. But come on. How is anyone, seriously, going to forget about a job that they've got? Right? I mean, most people have got one job. Let's say you've got two. I mean, some people have got maybe more than that. But let's say that you've got two jobs. I mean, you're really going to forget about that? Especially when you're applying for a loan and you know that income is all important. You're really going to forget about putting that job down?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
It's funny, that film, isn't it, The Great Short, because it is a great story. I think it's worth pointing out that it, like in typical Hollywood fashion, it presents it as the heroic story of one man who had a great idea, albeit perhaps one of slightly, you know, lower moral character. But in fact, there were years of legislation that went on in America and in the UK to ensure that that situation could come about, wasn't it, really?
I can't see, to be honest, I can't see how any amount of legislation would stop that happening. I can't, because ultimately, well, let's put it this way. As a manager, right, when I was running a branch, I had an approval limit, right? I could approve £20,000 secured. I could approve £10,000 unsecured.
Yeah.
Now, if I wanted to bend the rules, I could bend the rules as long as I wrote up why I was bending them.
Mitigating, right? Circumstances.
Absolutely. You know, and I made the mistake. You have to fall, right? You have to fall. In order to learn, you have to make a mistake. And I remember I made a loan, actually, for my local publican. We used to go in there every night after work, and I made them a loan, right? Against my better judgment. They seemed all right.
Yeah.
It was only a small loan, £3,000 or whatever. And they never paid me a penny. I was furious, right? I was absolutely furious because they knocked me, and they'd taken me for a ride. And that particular loan, I'd kind of bent the rules a little bit on it, right? And I'd helped it, right? I'd helped it as a favour. Yeah. And I got my fingers burnt, right? I mean, it didn't affect me in the job per se. It affected my figures slightly. But, you know, ultimately, when someone at ground level wants to approve something, they can.
Yeah.
Mm. It's really, you know, if a copper wants to turn a blind eye, can he? Of course he can.
Yeah, well, they've got discretion, haven't they? Mm.
Yeah, but even that aside, you know, it's just like, oh, I didn't see it.
Yeah.
You know, how can you prove that someone did? It's just, you know, it's like anything. You can make anything happen that you really want to happen.
Mm. Which is why the holding people to account, I think. I mean, I know that sometimes it's suggested you write to the chief executive officer by name and all this kind of stuff. But actually, there's a bit of me that feels that it's the people behind the sheet of glass, the people on the end of the phone, the guys we're actually dealing with who need to be made aware of this kind of stuff.
Well, I think so, because ultimately it impacts all of us.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all, you know, it's all well and good, you know, when you phone up a company, you know, unless you're getting on really, really well with the member of staff and you know, they can still be professional and they can still be down to earth and get along with customers. There's nothing, you know, I think that's the way people should be.
Mm.
But, you know, so much of the time when members of staff actually walk through that entrance, right, the entrance of their company building, and they walk and sit down into their department of the mind. They depart of the mind and they assume the company, you know, the company ethos, the company mentality takes over their mind. Mm. And it does. And they just don't think about what they're doing. And, you know, no one questions, okay, it's one transaction. What can one transaction do? Well, yeah, but that one transaction is being replicated in every company that is in the same industry, probably across the planet. And if you're doing something, you know, a little bit sailing close to the wind, as we used to say, then the chances are that other people are doing exactly the same because it's a competitive market out there and results matter.
Yeah. 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 And the funny thing is that it's all generating all of this money of account that we can't actually lay our hands on. Because it is funny that it does seem that it genuinely is kind of, in a real sense, actually our money and not theirs, such in as far as it exists at all.
Well, you have to, the entire system would not exist without us putting in.
No.
You have to put in first, right? You have to. You have to do something first in order to kickstart the relationship, right, with any kind of company. And usually that means depositing a piece of paper with your signature on it, right? And I know there are lots of companies now that have gone digital and they'll just take your say-so because, you know, ultimately, whether they've got the paperwork or not doesn't seem to bother many companies, especially when they're suing you, right?
Yeah.
It's just like, no, I... you know, I wasn't there. I don't know who you are, Mr. Goldberg, but at the end of the day, I've got your name, therefore you must owe us the money.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the way that it tends to go. But, you know, ultimately we have to deposit something. You know, going back to the days when everything was done with paper, we have to deposit some kind of, whether it's a contract, whether it's a promise, whether that contract involves a promise, and it usually does, it usually involves an agreement or a promise to pay some sum of money on a regular basis or in a lump sum, and that is the security, right? That's the security for the marriage. Yeah. And so, you know, in effect, every relationship that we're entering into with these companies, it's a marriage. I like to think of it as a marriage contract. Well, I don't like to think of it as a marriage contract, but it is a marriage contract, right?
It is arising as a result of intercourse, isn't it?
Well, commercial interaction is defined as intercourse.
Yeah.
You know, every letter has a date on it. All right. You have to sign where, you know, with a kiss. It's sealed with a kiss because X marks the spot. and you get screwed twice. It's called double entry.
Yeah.
Accounting.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Not just screwed, roasted.
And that is where you get screwed. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, but it is, because, you know, in the separation of the accounting entries, the private book, which is effectively what's owed back to us, that's being whisked away and used for whatever purpose by those that are controlling, you know, those books.
And, you know, it sounds like these things are actually published and distributed to the media, at least by some states in America. Have we got any way of seeing the total receipts and investment accounts of our county councils and city councils and county councils and all the rest, have we?
Well, I've tried it. I haven't pushed it. I mean, I've tried it. I've bowled into council buildings before, and I've just pretended to be someone that I'm not, and I've demanded to see them.
Mm.
I like to do my acting from time to time and practice.
Seems to be a good way of getting things. The man Burial's really good at that as well. Says that he's so-and-so, he's working for so-and-so, he needs to get the report done before he gets back from holiday tomorrow, and can he have this information, please?
honestly, right, if you've ever seen Eddie Murphy, Beverly Hills Cop, number one,
yeah,
and he goes into the warehouse and he just flashes his badge, doesn't he, and he just says, I'm this, because, you know, let's face it, if you had the balls to go in and say that you're, you know, who would go into somewhere and declare that they're something that they're not?
Well, we know it works, don't we? We know people are pulling off huge stunts just by carrying a clipboard and wearing a fluoro jacket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, why not just go bowl into the council and ask to see these reports? But,
I've been recommending that people take up a bit of amateur drama for just that reason. It does enable you to pretend to be something else with some conviction.
Well, I've done this a few times. I often, just for a bit of a giggle, you know, would go out and assume an accent and go into various places and start talking to people as if I'm a foreigner.
Yeah.
And I just sit, and sometimes they'd be, you can see them sniggering. So,
yeah.
But you just carry on. And
yeah.
They must be going through the thought process, well, is this guy for real or not? I can't really laugh at him, you know, yeah. Or you give a funny name, you know. And I used to do it all the time, winding up colleagues in other branches. But, you know, making false applications but giving a funny name, you know, and seeing if they would carry it off. But, you know, one thing with the councils, I think it's from memory, Local Government Finance Bill 1984, Section 17, I think from memory, you can go in to your local council and you can audit their receipts. They have to provide you with a room, a photocopier, and you get 2 weeks.
Wicked. You'd have to take in a fair few poppadoms to keep you going through that.
Well, myself.
That's an interest. Has anyone tried doing that?
Well, I've done it. South End Council.
Great.
Yeah. Myself and my old work colleague back in 2006 went and did it. And I'm sure it was the 1984 Act. I'm sure it is Section 17.
That's what you're after, is their receipts, isn't it? They've got to be these books. Because apparently, I mean, according to Burial anyway, it's a matter of non-disclosure. It is actually in the public thing, but nobody talks about it and nobody looks for them.
Mm.
So it's got to be, well, I know that Pete Kroll's been doing a bit of work on our local county council and has discovered that they, whilst pulling about $62 million a year in council tax, they have, like I say, those £300 million in unusable reserves is what they're called. But nobody will tell us what they are.
So I think it's about 800,000 for South End or Rochford District Council down this way.
800,000, yeah. 800 million.
And, oh, sorry, 800 million probably. Yeah. Sorry.
And apparently it's cumulative. Apparently these are all separate entities, so the value of one is not included in the value of any of the others. So if you've got, like, a city and a school district and a county and a state, then you've got the cumulative value of all of them. And like I said, he says there's 54,700 government corporations writing these reports, apparently, in the states. And the thing, his point is that if you can find out that the people have been receiving them, then when you say to them, I'd like to see this, and they say, I don't know what it is, you know they're lying to you and that you have to go to somebody else. And what he's doing is he's encouraging anybody who's running for office, be it anything, he says, from sheriff to dog catcher, to make simple and clear reference in a public medium to these funding reports. And he says if they don't do it, you know that they've bought into the system and you need to be voting for somebody else.
Sure. But, I mean, you think about it, really, the members of staff, if everyone was kind of clued up, right, and this is the lethargy, really, this is where we've all kind of gone wrong as a collective, you think how many people working there would have access to this, but they don't raise the question. And even when you raise the question with them, they still don't go and investigate, right? Mm. Now, perhaps people out there, I don't know, maybe I almost got a job with the council.
That would have been interesting.
Well, it was quite funny because, I think it's like 2010 time, actually. So I was into this kind of stuff, and I went along to Basildon Council, and I got through the first interview, and the guy that was interviewing me, in fact, there were three people interviewing me, but two people the first time round, and the main head honcho, he kind of intimated to me that I was the strongest candidate, and then I had to come back for a second interview, but I pretty much had it in the bag, right? That's what I was basically being told, you got it in the bag. So I went back for the second interview, and somehow he got onto fraud. And I said, well, this is right towards the end of the interview, right? And it's all been going well. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, don't worry about that, because I used to investigate fraud at the bank. Mm-hmm. I said, if there's fraud going on here, I guarantee you I'll get it, right? I'll find mm-hmm. it. I didn't get the job.
Wonder why.
Right? So... You know, the thing is, though, maybe one or two people out there should perhaps consider, doing a stint at the local council.
Well, what we've thought about doing, because there's a lot of trouble with them closing schools, and as a result, they've been doing webcasts of council meetings, and instead of the 37-member council making the decision, it's the 12-member cabinet and stuff like that, and they're all behaving like a right bunch of toadies, you can see it, and the local people are really angry. And so our idea is that we'll start going to the council meetings to see what they're talking about. Then we'll have a bit of a party and a get-together afterwards mm-hmm. and try and get under, at least as a group, at least one thing we've heard them talking about, and just start letting them know that somebody's watching, because mm-hmm. we think that'll make a difference. They're not used to people coming to their meetings. They're really not.
No, not at all.
Well, I mean, there were a couple of important points. I mean... If I can remember what they were, I was going to say.
It does happen, myself. Unfortunately.
Yeah, I'll throw myself. Okay. In the first instance, with regards to some of the, with that council stuff, I know a good few years back, there were quite a few people that were actually doing that and heading along to council meetings. And then they were finding that at certain points of the meeting, it was then being deemed to be private and everyone was being asked to leave. Right. So yeah. The public were being, you know, the public gallery was being cleared and there were one or two points on the agenda that were going to be covered, but in private. And,
love free and open democracy.
Yeah. But ultimately, you know, these people have got to understand, certainly the people that are in public service have got to understand that if they're going to continue operating the way that they're operating, they cannot blame members of the public. Whatever you want to call, however we want to refer to ourselves, they can't blame members of the public for suddenly saying, well, then in which case I'm going to abstain from that. I'm not going to do it, right? Because if you're not going to be playing fair, why should I, right? Why should I? So if you're not going to play fair, well, then maybe I won't play fair, right? Mm. And, you know, it's justification for the non-payment of council tax. It's justification for the non-payment of tax. It's justification for lots of things. Now, there were a couple of recent things which came up. After the Brexit. So, you know, you've got Brexit. I don't know if you heard in the press. We voted to get out of Europe.
I did hear a rumour.
It will never happen.
Right. And
I agree, Mark. We know it's not going to happen because Theresa May said we definitely weren't going to have a Second Amendment, referendum, which can only mean that we are going to, because they always lie to us.
Yeah. Well, remember, I read a book, according to Lord Denning, all you have to do is repeal the 1972 Act and we're out.
Lord Denning, wicked, I didn't know that, that's good.
That was in a book by Lord Nolan and Stephen Sedley, The Making and Remaking of the British Constitution, and he quoted Lord Denning because obviously they were referring to Europe, and Lord Denning had written this little piece, obviously when he was around, effectively saying that that's all that's needed to effectively put the kibosh on that. But I do think it's quite funny that the fact that there's a two-year lead-in period to us leaving, where no doubt we still have to pay whatever money's into the euro. But obviously with Brexit, you know, you've got then Frexit and Swexit and Dyslexic and stuff like that right? But it led me on to, you then saw in the papers the call for London to be declared independent. Did you see that?
I did. I thought it was.
That's the small part called the City of London. But London was talking about, you know, they were talking about, the Mayor of London was now talking with, I can't think of her name now, from Scotland. And they were talking about...
Nicola, you know, Sturgeon.
Sturgeon. They were talking about Scotland, you know, where Scotland and London were going to declare independence. Now, does that not show you that it's possible to declare independence from the UK state? You see, in 1949, there was an Ealing Studios film called Passport to Pimlico. Right? Where... You know, in the film, some kids had knocked this tire down this old well or something, and it exploded this bomb, or there was an unexploded bomb down there. It blew up, and this parchment came to light, which effectively said that, you know, a couple of streets around Pimlico were actually part of this French French guy's dukedom or whatever it was, right? Mm. So they were suddenly realised that they're nothing to do with the UK, and so they declared independence, right? Now, the point is, it kind of highlights the fact that it's possible. And I read that film, and hopefully I'll get some of these facts correct from memory, but it was based on true actual events where I think it was Princess Margaret of the Netherlands was giving birth in Canada, and she was at the Ottawa Civic Hospital. And in order to maintain the right to the Dutch throne, right, for the little one, they temporarily declared the hospital as an extraterrestrial jurisdiction.
Brilliant. How far out's that? That's great.
Well, it's off the planet, right?
How far do you want to go?
Or should I say it's out of this world? Because the world is a fiction and the Earth is a planet, which is real, right? Now, I've seen some other writings, and I'm going to hopefully do a video on this. Apparently it's from the London School of Economics, where there's a definition of the state. And the state is described as taking on a life all of its own, right? It's abstract. It doesn't really exist. And it is described as an alien power.
Yes.
This is from the London School of Economics.
Well, if you think, break it down, it's alien, isn't it? Not capable of taking a lien.
Yeah. Mm. Mm. But the point is, with all of that, as fabulously interesting as that is, I hope... it kind of shows that it's possible.
Yes.
It can be done, right? So if that can be done, then that means that there's nothing to stop us with the right strategy for implementing it to actually take over pockets of this fine island and declare them independent.
Mm. I've always found that having looked into all the land rights and the bloody laws and the amount of hassle people are getting for approaching it in almost any way, I had more or less concluded that what you need to do is get your acre or whatever, put a fence around it, stick a flag up it with a lock on the gates, and just act as if you are independent.
Or convert or open the minds of your immediate neighbours, locale.
Yeah.
You know, if you could do that, because, you know, ultimately, you know, the internet is brilliant in terms of getting stuff out there. It's accessible. Thanks, Tony. I'm glad to hear I'm always interesting. You know, with the internet, you know, it's very difficult thinking about it. You know, we want these pockets because there's lots of people dotted around, right?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, we're kind of dispersed that, you know, you're lucky if you've got someone a couple of streets away and so on and so forth. And what we really need are pockets of people, because that's where the real power comes from. When you've got maybe 200-400 people on your doorstep that are singing from the same hymn sheet, right, and have got the same line of thinking, Well, that's when it becomes really, really powerful. Now, I've, you know, I way back, I used to date a girl who lived in an unadopted road. They'd unadopted the road from the council, and they had gates up. No one was allowed in. It was a private road, right? So it can be done. And I know you can make a proposal to the council to unadopt your road.
Right.
Now, as I say, the internet is fantastic for putting stuff out there. It makes it easily accessible to basically anyone, right, who goes on the internet. But in many respects, some of the most powerful stuff we could potentially do is to actually go face to face and bring it back down, because, you know, there's lots of noise agents on the internet. There's lots of people that can put up misinformation, disinformation, even with all the right information and different perspectives, it can become confusing for people and so on and so forth. And so, you know, what can't, that can be policed on the internet, right? To some extent. I know we say it can't, but it can be, the waters can be muddied.
Yeah.
Face to face, you will never really remove the power in face-to-face communication, because that is people.
Yeah, that's where the only reality is, I've concluded, is with people looking eyeball to eyeball, and the kind of the rest of it is a story, and it only becomes real when you're dealing with the individuals who are playing their part in their story, and then it comes momentarily real for you whilst you deal with it.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, we're going to be holding a webinar at some point in time, because, you know, I wanted to expand, and excuse my smoking, I wanted to expand upon this idea of really, you know, getting back down to ground level. You know, I'm a Taurian, that's an earth sign, and, you know,
being happy in the,
that's a load of ball, yeah.
Happy in the China shop as anywhere, eh, Simon?
You know, bringing it back down to ground level, and, yeah, and just talking to people.
Yeah.
You know, I appreciate that if we go off on one too much, people will look at you like you're a nutter. But the idea, but in effect, what we have to do is at ground level, we have to kind of approach this in the way that people are used to accepting new information or new ideas. Yes. And that is to do a sales job on them.
Yes, quite so. Right? Or what's known as a propaganda attack.
Yeah, but in a nice, yeah, simple, honest way. Mm. And so, you know, at some point, I've already warned people on the White Rabbit email list, and we're going to be doing a webinar on that at some point in time, really to reveal, I guess, my strategy, and I'm going to try and coach people on, you know, the ways in which I found most success in terms of getting people interested, right?
Brilliant. Very useful thing to be doing, mate.
Absolutely. Well, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I think so, because, you know, ultimately, I want to see a change come about. I'd love to see it in my lifetime, you know? But I figure that the only way to really do that, and to go relatively unseen, because there's, you know, I know we'd all like to wake up tomorrow and there's been a huge awakening and everyone is completely conscious and they're fully self-aware and they're fully respectful of everybody else and so on and so forth. But I don't know that that's necessarily going to happen. But, you know, you don't necessarily want to get from point A to point B and not admire the journey and not take it in. Yeah. And so I think in many respects, rather than, you know, wanting to rush through this, I think we've got to maybe take some enjoyment out of the journey and watching those parties that are up to no good squirm a bit, right?
Yeah. And well, that's always, for you, that's always been a major part of it. You've always said it's got to be fun, you know.
It's fun. It is fun.
Yeah.
But why not surprise them? Keep it under the radar, right? It's not even on the radar, because you're now conversing face-to-face.
Exactly right. Right? Yeah.
And so you get a swell that's not even seen. People don't see it coming, right? But you have an underground, you know, you have this groundswell. I mean, you know, I'm not so sure, you know, when the Brexit thing happened, as far as I'm concerned, whether it was a yay or a nay, you know, it's a choice between bullshit and dog shit. Either way, you're getting the shit end of the stick, right?
Right, right, yeah, yeah.
What we need, really, is, in my opinion, is that this is a prime opportunity for change. Now, you know, I've been going back over the foundations of the legal system, our beloved legal system, systems of law and government. Right? I've been going back over that, revisiting it, right? Because I wanted to pick holes in it, right? No other reason. I wanted to find arguments and I wanted to raise questions with it to show that, you know, if you're building your house on quicksand, it's going to collapse. The chances are it's going to collapse. And so I wanted to look at these kind of foundations of this entire system. And, you know, one of the things which comes out from the legal system is that, you know, the system of law is supposed to be founded on the moral, it's supposed to reflect the morals and the standards within society, right? So you could say, well, what does our current system tell us about the standards of this society?
Yeah.
Right? That could be one question. But in reading, and I've read, you know, I'm reading at the moment the course for the for paralegals, and I'm going through the foundations for, you know, what solicitors would study. And this stuff is just kind of, you know, it's at the beginning of these books and the courses, and it's almost, it's just like a matter of fact. Well, you know, look, it's, we kind of pinpoint 1066, William the Conqueror, so it's founded on conquest. Immigrants, right? Immigrants. Who came over from, you know, the Normans came over and displaced Vikings and Anglo-Saxons. Other immigrants. We've had immigrants here for years, right? Yeah. We're all immigrants. All of us are. But the law has to be changeable. It has to be changeable. And that's the point. It's a case of, well, hold on a second. How can we, anyone associated with this conscious movement or awakening, how can anyone be deemed to be anything other than just moving with the times and moving with our awareness of what's going on and seeking to change the law and to move the law in line with our moral compass?
Which is how it was designed, as you say, to work.
It's exactly how it's designed to work. It's what it's supposed to be. And in actual fact, you know, one of the foundations within their game, where they point to their common law being case law, precedent. When you look at the first few hundred years of how precedent came into being, case law, and how this was all gathered, even in these legal courses, it cites bribery, corruption for the decision-making process or within the decision-making process, right? Well, that's not exactly a healthy foundation. In The Guardian, just a few years back, it was cited that international companies were coming to the UK to fight their cases because the judges could be bribed.
Yeah.
Right? That's in The Guardian, right?
Yes, yeah. There's massive, apparently there's a massive, libel industry built on exactly that.
Right. But not only that, but according to the rules of how these judges set case law, if something had been kind of set in stone or certain practice over whatever many cases and precedents and so on and so forth, if a judge, based on his own opinion and his own experience, feels that society has moved in a certain direction, and it means that he doesn't have to stick to case law, he can break it.
But that's only his society that needs to move.
But that's based on his experience, yeah, and his upbringing, and, yeah, and this and his opinion. So what value is case law?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, an interesting point. Yeah. Always changeable. It's a bit like the science, isn't it? The science is always reaching conclusions and then reaching another conclusion tomorrow. I mean, we've come to like 11 o'clock. Are you all right to hang on for 10 or 15 minutes whilst I deal with one or with some questions from the chat?
Yeah.
Is that cool? Because
yeah,
there was nobody on after us. So
I haven't finished my cigarette, so yeah.
Brilliant. From the chat room, on the subject of movies, Midrin asked earlier on whether you've ever seen The House of Rothschild, 1934.
It's on the White Rabbit Trust YouTube channel, and yes, I have watched it.
There you
and
go,
there's
yeah,
an interesting comment in there when Armshaw Rothschild is on his deathbed and he's explaining set off to his sons. Check that section out. It's in the middle of the film.
Yeah.
Right? And check out what he says about when one of the customers from Vienna wanted to draw out cash in London. The Vienna branch, if I'm remembering this right, I could get this wrong, but let's hope I get it right. He said that you would write a letter to London instructing them to release monies to the guy while he's in London. That's a bill.
Yeah.
For all intents and purposes. Yeah. He goes to his son, and you in London would offset that by making a loan back to Vienna. Right? Now, that you'd offset it, right? You'd offset it. Now, we're giving a credit agreement, right? Think, well, you do the math, right? Think about the process we go through and who you're instructing. Right, man signs the document instructing that it's paid to man's person.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it's offset with a loan back to you, right?
That sounds like a good business.
Great business to be in. But that was a fantastic propaganda movie, and it is on the White Rabbit Trust YouTube channel.
And again, that's how a lot... Yeah, thanks for that. I thought it was. That's why I thought it was a good question. Yeah. Yes, an interesting point. I haven't watched that one. I'll have to give that a look. Midgen also asked another interesting question. This is a more left-field one. He says, what do you think of the idea of scrapping the existing currency in favour of soft mints?
At least there'd be some substance to it.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't leave such a sour taste in your mouth. But
sweet idea, really.
I do
sweet
feel...
Sweet idea, yeah.
Well, let's put it this way, right? I think, as far as I'm concerned, the country... We could change the monetary system overnight. There need be no hiccups to the economy or this, that, and the other. There need be none of that. If we did an Iceland, kicked out the international bankers, or preferably arrested them, but let's say we kick them out, government takes over all the bank branches, right? Just because of convenience for people, yeah. So that there's no knock-on effect, there's no negative knock-on effect. Takes over all the existing bank branches, runs them as, you know, from government, for the people of the people.
It more or less took them all over in 2008 anyway. It just didn't choose to run them.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's say we had an honest government, right?
Yeah.
which kind of implies something, but I'm not going to say it. But anyway, so we've got an honest, transparent government, and they can then create the funds that's needed to provide the best public services on the face of the planet, and the money that's created does not have to be paid back.
And
overnight, no income tax, and people effectively get 2.5 weeks extra holiday and better public services.
Yeah, at the very least, if the...
Sorry, 2.5 weeks holiday per month.
Thank you. Yeah, quite right. That sounds more like it. Yep. Yes, indeed. So, yeah, that's a good idea. And anyway, the soft mints are probably worth more than the money is. here's one.
If you put a rabbit on one, it'd be a white rabbit, then.
Yeah. We got one from Rob F, and his questions are always interesting. He's saying, and I'll have to be careful how I say this probably, are Simon and Mark aware of bottomry?
No.
Yeah, that's where they insured the keel, isn't it?
Insured the keel of the boat.
Mm.
All right.
Oh, well, perhaps we've gotten there. Rob, well done. You score points on that one. If you want to put the answer in the chat box, we'll read it out.
Yeah, give us the answer.
Yeah. I think it was Lee who asked, is the ship of state insured and who's got the paperwork, implying that he thinks it probably is?
Well, who do you reckon it's insured by?
Us.
Us, yeah. Yep. We're paying the premiums.
Yeah.
And we're underwriting it. We're paying the premiums and underwriting it.
Yeah, we're the surety. We're the surety of, you know, we're the insurer of last resort. Your Bank of England is the bank of last resort, and we're the insurer of last resort.
Wow. Yeah. Yes. So, there you go. It is. Actually, I heard once that our passport is some sort of insurance when we're in Europe as well. Do you know anything about that?
It's supposed to be.
Well, I guess it's an insurance that you can get back. Or that you can get help.
I believe it also makes somebody else responsible for most of what you do, so long as you're not actually causing any criminal titty for laugh.
Mm. The one of the ideas behind the passport is that when you go abroad, the citizens of that country, or certainly the people in charge of that country, are supposed to look after you on behalf of your origin country.
Right.
You know, like you are special cargo or something like that.
Mm, yeah. Yes, I thought that was the case. So that was that's the ship of state. Oh, right, and here's one really from left field for Lee. He says, can Simon give a quote for damage by angry dragons?
What? Damage by angry dragons? A quote? God knows. I can't think of anything from Game of Thrones, let's put it that way. That's the first that came to my mind, Game of Thrones. But
it is kind of what they're doing, though, isn't it? They're kind of giving you a quote for Angry Dragons, more or less, whatever it is you turn for them to do.
Well, I tell you what, Game of Thrones, right, it's I love it. It's effectively the way that it all works, right? You've got the Iron Bank, you've got the Lannisters, their logo is a lion, right? And they're supposed to have loads of gold, but they haven't got any gold, right? So they're in debt to the Iron Bank, right?
Yeah.
Then you've got obviously the wall, which divides north and south, effectively Hadrian's Wall, right? You've then got these living dead beings, which are coming to attack everyone. Okay, well, obviously it's corporates, right?
Corporates,
yeah. Yeah, the corporates, right? We're bringing the dead corporate entities to life. But it just amazes me how, you know, you've got the two pillars, you've got the faith and the crown, as was said by Cersei Lannister. And you've got all the houses that are just effectively out. You know, all these people that would be king are just killing each other for the power.
Yeah.
It's exactly what it is. It's exactly what it is. I mean, ultimately, you know, you could be forgiven for saying that the whole system is just a protection racket. You know, yes, we'll protect you, but if you don't want to be part of it, we're going to force you to be part of it.
Yeah. Yes.
And there's a Lysander Spooner quote, which I put up on a video, where he's basically saying, look, you know, the theory of government is that, you know, government is an insurance, a mutual insurance company, or society is a mutual insurance company whereupon we all agree to contribute and to insure each other's interests, right? But just as we can decide to be insured, so we can decide and be protected by that, so we can opt not to be protected by that. But, you know, as I say, just to go back to that comment, the problem is if you decide you don't want to be protected by that, someone comes along and forces you to be protected by that.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's a protection racket.
It is. Yes, indeed. And it is basically feudal as well. It is. It's, you know, somebody with a sword taking money off somebody who hasn't got a sword and giving it to a bloke with a crown.
Yeah. You know, you go along with me and, you know, I'll make you a lord. You can live like a king, but I'll be the king and I'll just wear the crown.
That's
basically what it is. That's exactly what it is.
Endless story of dick slapping and willy waggling. That's what it is. Talking of which, Rob Freeman says, you're right, Mark. Well done. There you get a gold star as well. He's put bottomry, brackets insurance, is a bottomry or bottomage is an arrangement in which the master of a ship borrows money upon the bottom or keel of it, so as to forfeit the ship itself to the creditor if the money with interest is not paid at the time appointed at the ship's safe return.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Interesting. Well done, Mark.
Yeah. So, well done. You actually fielded all of those quite bizarre questions with a great deal of equanimity. before I let you go, there's something I'd like to cover quickly that was in your DVD, because it's a subject that comes up quite a lot, and I think it'd be good just to talk about it so that it's on the podcast and stuff. And that is this idea that UK PLC has been bankrupt for the last 200 or 300 years or so. And I know that you told a story about a boat that went down with some gold on it and connected that with this. Are we bankrupt, and how did it happen?
Right, okay. Well, there's two things. Once I've talked about that, remind me to talk about the webinar on the mortgage. The four techniques to reduce your capital balance on your mortgage, right? But anyway, right. So first and foremost, when I was watching Lloyd's of London, the time that it's set, okay. If you can imagine the opening scene to the film, you've got two young lads. You've got Jonathan Blake as a youngster. So he must be about 13, and he's a local peasant, and his best mate is Horatio Nelson, right? Who's getting ready to be shipped off to a naval school. Anyhow, Jonathan Blake just happens to be down the docks one day, and he overhears a couple of likely ship owners who are conspiring to make some money. Now, one of the ship owners is saying to the other guy, he said, look, I've just been given a job. I've got to take a hold load of gold over to wherever he was going. He goes, but I'll tell you what, why don't I move the gold from my boat to your boat? I'll take my boat out into the sea, sink it, right? The insurance will pay out, but we get the gold, right? We get to keep the gold. Because
troubles all around.
Everyone will think it's at the bottom of the ocean and no one can get it, right? Because we haven't got the technology to go and get it, right? Now, the young lad then goes off to Lloyd's of London, and that's how the story kind of unfolds, because he goes and grasses them up, and that, you know, reveals the fraud, and everybody's happy, and he ends up being adopted by one of the guys at Lloyd's Coffee House, and then he ends up becoming the star of the show in Lloyd's of London. However, in 1792 or 1793, the English fleet captured a French vessel, which was called the Lutine, right? L-U-T-I-N-E, right? And I think it became HMS Lutine. And in 1799, the HMS Lutine was given the task of delivering a whole load of gold over to the continent to help prop up German banks, which were financing the war against Napoleon, right? Unfortunately,
yeah. Yep.
This is going to end. Isn't it?
Unfortunately,
oh, no.
the boat sank off the coast of the Netherlands in an area of sandbanks called the Vlie Stroom. Right now, I'm very big. I look at words, and you know, I quite often take some of these weird words and I stick them into an anagram finder. Right. Well, it just so happens that the Vlie Stroom happens to come out as Evil's motor. Right. Now, if you consider that insurance underpins the whole of the commercial world, well, then I guess you could say, and if you considered the commercial world to be a little bit evil, well, then I guess you could say it is Evil's motor, right? So that's a bit of a coincidence, right? Anyhow, this boat sinks, stranded on these sandbanks, and there are different reports as to how deep this water is, right? But no one, as I understand it, no one survived, right? And the gold has never been recovered. However, Lloyd's laid claim to the gold that was at the bottom of the sea, right? So no doubt that was fulfilling some of their capital requirements for their insurance policies. However, they did manage to retrieve the bell. And it sits in Lloyd's of London. It's called the Lutin Bell, which just happens to sound like Lutin when you go Lutin on a riot. Right?
And they ring it every time a ship fails to make it, don't they?
As I understand it, yeah, they ring it when there's a claim. So it's just a bit of a coincidence. And I just thought to myself, well, hold on, 1799, when I spoke to the debt management office, right, way back when, I was making a few calls round because I was trying to ascertain the whereabouts or whether people understood, you know, our line of thinking that there was some kind of account to represent our value on the books of the state, which was then used, whether it's by the Chancellor or whatever, to then, you know, borrow against or to offset against or to maybe pilfer and use the fictional digits that are in there for their own benefit. And when I was explaining it, when I phoned up the debt management office, I tried to be as cagey as possible. And I wanted to speak to, I just tried to drop a few hints. And I said that I was phoning up for, you know, with regards to a private estate matter, and I needed to speak to a director or senior bod. And anyway, within about literally 10 minutes or so, a senior bod phoned me back. And I had about a 40-minute conversation with this guy, and I was hinting quite strongly along those lines. And amazingly, he kind of guessed what I was getting at, right? He guessed what I was getting at. And I then said to him, I said, well, when did we go into bankruptcy? I said, you know, and he came out with a figure. He said, late 1700s.
Really?
Now, on the basis that periods of administration should last 70 years, and whenever it looked like we were getting out of bankruptcy, something would happen to push us back into bankruptcy. Well, if you work 70 years forward from 1799, you've then got 1869, which was the Bankruptcy Act. Uh-huh. Add another 70 years, you've got 1939. Oh, Second World War.
Yeah.
Add another 70 years, you've got, what's that, 2009?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's that? So was that Iraq, Kuwait?
Yeah,
one of those,
wasn't it?
Mm.
Markets have crashed in 2008. Massive bailouts keep us in bankruptcy because the system can only operate in bankruptcy. It's got to be in the bankruptcy. Mm. It's got to be so that we are forced to put in, because while a company's in administration, it's got no funds, right? So you've got to put in order to keep it running. And you know, and this kind of leads me on to. You know, look, it's something I've said with Mark on some of the shows. Isn't it ironic the way that we spend, you know, we say time is money and we spend time and we burn energy, right? Burning energy, earn, holds the ashes, you earn money. So, you know, that's the ashes, that's dead, that's gone, that energy's gone, we've burnt it, we've spent time, that's gone. We're not going to get that time back. So there we are, spending time, burning energy in order to obtain bank currency. So we're exchanging our currency for bank currency. And so often our goal in life is to acquire so much bank currency that we can retire early and buy ourselves time. Now, in that process, you've washed, right? Or perhaps it's been laundered, but you've washed, right, that currency through the bank's currency, and it comes out as less than you put in.
Yeah.
A lot less.
A lot less, yeah.
Right? A lot less than you've put in. Now, law of nature is that, you know, everything must return to source. Everything must return to source.
Is that why the money always goes back to the bank at the end of the game?
Well, it should come back to us because we are the energy banks.
It should, yeah.
Okay, and it's being blocked, it's being clogged. And, you know, ultimately, when enough people realise that, and make the demands, okay, that's when you see the whole thing change. Because what we believe we owe to them, they actually owe back to us. So we're actually weighing credit with what we've been putting into the system.
Mm.
And, you know, all I can say is, look, I'm not the king, I'm not the prime minister. I wouldn't want to be the king, I wouldn't want to be the prime minister. But if I were, I would say to everyone, keep your receipts, right? Because whatever receipts you've got to justify what you've put into the system, we'll give you back with the new currency that we create for the people of the people by the people.
Right.
We'll buy those receipts off of you because you deserve to have that back, right? You should be getting that back. But it's taken, it's just a tax, you know? It's all taken. Most of it is in tax. 80% of our lifetime's earnings on average is taken in tax.
Yeah.
So if you had that back, that's where the 2.5 weeks per month additional holiday comes from. We should only be, let's put it this way, tribal people, right, mud huts and all that jazz, they work on average 4 hours a day.
Mm.
Now, we've got technology. Why are we working 10 hours a day? Yeah. In fact, there's a news report today in the Daily Mail which states that, I think it was about 80% of people or whatever, are actually working longer hours that they don't get paid for. Mm. Because you work your lunch break, you've got to impress the boss, you get in early. I used to do it. You get in early, you leave late.
Yeah.
Because it's expected, and you don't get paid for it.
Mm. And there's more and more of that going on.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah, and we've got technology, which was supposed to reduce our workload, but in actual fact, we've found ourselves working longer to try and keep pace with computers, which is impossible.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So it's wrong. It's just not working the way that it's supposed to be working. And I can even remember adverts and seeing some of these 50s films. You know, technology will change the world. Yeah. It will change your home life. Yeah, I haven't got a home life. you know, but...
Lee's put a couple of interesting things, and Rob, into the chat box. Lee's, this is very good, what you were saying about the lutein going down in 1799. Income tax, he's put, this was, looks like it's from the nationalarchives.gov. Income tax was announced in 1798 and introduced in 1799 as a means of paying for the war against the French forces under Napoleon. But get this, here's another one, if I can get it, sorry. Rob's put in, the 70-year bankruptcy cycle played out over and over is the 70 years and 10 mentioned in the Bible. I like that one.
Yep.
And then here's another one from Lee. The concept of credit or imaginary money emerged during the 1799 period. Also, it was realized that money could take on new forms, possess no intrinsic value, and yet still retain qualities to fulfill payment obligations, or to effect payment, at least.
Especially when it's forced on the people.
Yeah. And therefore, at the same time, the national debt was born. But as we've mentioned several times, the national debt is an illusion. All of the things you've referred to, all of the technologies and stuff like that, because a few farmers with a few hand tools can produce food for loads of people, with all the tools and all the communications we've got, evidently we are creating plenty, but it's just being removed from us. And insurance is one of the ways they're doing it.
Yeah, because scarcity pushes up prices. It's good for the bottom line.
That's what he says. He says it's absolutely vital that people do not realise that they are living in times of plenty, because that's what keeps it all spinning.
And that's what keeps people scared, and that's what keeps them buying, and that's what keeps them locked into their own little world, you know, because they're terrified.
Mm.
They're terrified of, you know, who's going to put their trust in, you know, well, I don't need to worry about that because I know that I'll probably happen upon some food on my way, you know, down to the local wherever tomorrow. You know, people don't want to necessarily do that. And I don't think people have to do that. But I tell you what, while we're on that subject, because one of the biggest balls and chains that a lot of people have is their mortgage payment, right?
Yeah.
And we've got a number of shows coming out. We've filmed them already, and we've got a number of shows coming out which briefly cover 4 proven methodologies for reducing your capital balance, or what you end up paying in respect of your mortgage debt, right? Because there's, you know, I've kind of predicted this to anyone that actually heard me say it at seminars, etc. You know, I kind of predicted that as more and more people become aware of how these things work and start challenging them, you know, there is going to come a time when barristers and solicitors are going to start jumping on board. Because even if they foresee that, you know, let's say that there's a window within which this existing monetary system in its current form can survive before collapsing, right, or becoming defunct, yeah, there's a window, and that window is a window of opportunity. Yeah. And If that window of opportunity means that barristers and solicitors and legal bods just have to turn around and attack the hand that was previously feeding them, and believe me, there are a lot of barristers who haven't got enough work, and there are a lot of solicitors who have not got enough work, and they're being screwed, especially with some of these things which were previously provided for by the state, some certain funding, legal aid and things like that, where, you know, solicitors are literally not able to continue trading. And it wouldn't take long before self-interest, you know, overrides the kind of old boy network goals, as it were. And that's exactly what we're seeing. We're seeing barristers now coming out. You know, I've made connections with a number of them who are coming out, and they are attacking these products. And I've got to tell you, every single stage of a mortgage product is there to be attacked, because the mortgage product is a fudge. They had to fudge it because, strictly speaking, the term mortgage, right, meant that if you were going to have one of these arrangements, the item that you were seeking to buy on finance had to stay in the possession of the bank until you'd paid for it. Well, clearly that can't work with your bricks and mortar home.
Yeah.
So they had to fudge the product. Now, what we've actually got is we've got a product where the mortgage, the security, is not the bricks and mortar. The security, the true security in the sense of the word, is the paper that's in the possession of the bank. Just as an unsecured loan agreement is a security, and that's in the possession of the bank, just as a contract held by the bank is the security, just as a bond held by the bank is the security, right? That a security is something which makes a party more assured of the performance of the person paying.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So getting it in writing makes me more assured of your performance than if we had a verbal agreement. Right. Because I've got it in writing. Right. So that's the security. Now, we've produced, you know, four shows which are coming out soon. And they're leading up to a webinar, which we're going to do, which is then ultimately going to lead on to a full blown weekend intensive workshop for those that feel they need it. But the webinar is going to be announced fairly soon. And I know we've got some handouts on the subject which are going to be available for those who want to subscribe. It costs you nothing. Go onto the You and Your Cash website, youandyourcash.com, and you can just subscribe, and you'll get this when it's finished. You'll get these handouts with regards to mortgage products, and then once the shows on these four methodologies have been put out there, those handouts will be available, and they're going to lead people and provide people with an opportunity to attend a webinar where we'll talk a little bit more in depth, but for the full blown ins and outs with assistance and, you know, real kind of one-to-one, not one-to-one, but, you know, tutorage as such, as to how these things operate, that's going to take place over a weekend.
Yeah. And it has to be said that the kind of techniques you'll be talking about are actually more generally applicable than just to mortgages as well, aren't they?
Because In fact, one of them is just alter the way you pay.
Yeah.
You don't even have to challenge it. You don't even have to have an argument. You just alter the way you pay. But I think Mark's got something to say here.
Yeah, just a quick one. This isn't actually generally released yet. It's not due out until next week. But we've given you a special link that your listeners can actually go on to and get on early. So they'll get it as soon as it comes out.
Yes, I've put that in the chat box, and I'll put it in there again when we finish. But I won't read it out, so it's not on the podcast. Ha ha, tough. You should listen to it in the all your pod listeners.
It's a special one that just for you.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. I appreciate that, and I shall certainly be having a look at that. Sounds very interesting. Let's face it, it's one of the biggest challenges we face. It's also one of the most corrupt, as far as I can tell, in that there isn't anything righteous about the process at all. But that was brilliant, Simon and Mark. Thank you so much for coming and spending another couple of hours of your time with us. It was great. Again, I look forward to hearing the pod when I can concentrate more.
No, pleasure, mate. Pleasure. Anytime.
Well, I know that you're up to various things that you want to keep under wraps, Simon. So I'm sure we're going to have a chance for having you back when some of that comes to fruition.
Yeah, and one of them does. You know, for people that have seen some of the videos on the White Rabbit, they'll be aware of a saga, and that saga is hopefully turning the corner in my favour. And I can't say too much about it yet, but once it's once it's done, I will reveal what kind of happened.
Excellent. Well, you're welcome to come on and talk about it here first. That would be really great. In the meantime, I must say that the videos on youandyourcash.com are a really excellent way of introducing people to these difficult subjects, doing exactly what Simon and Mark do so well, which is basically explain things in simple, non-terrifying and pretty undeniable terms. Mostly, you can be terrifying. You can. Youandyourcash.com is not like that. It's really great. It's and the other thing I really got to say again is that the your first DVD set, Simon, the Welcome to the Rabbit Hole, with six DVDs, giving us a well-thought-out insider's view of how it's all structured, I have found to be extremely accessible to the layman. I've been showing them to people. And Synchro did say that she really feels she understands the money thing now because of your goldsmith's tale. And she's actually become, as I was saying to you, she's become really voluble on the subject of where money comes from. And can't be stopped talking to everybody about it. It's only 22 quid, guys. And once you've got it, you can show it to other people. And if you want an intro for straight people to difficult subjects, I haven't seen a better one. And I haven't got any financial interest in it at all. Simon's just my mate. And they are really good.
Well, I've got, you know, look, at the end of the day, we've got a mortgage DVD available. I mean, and again, you know, Mark brings the added bonus of professionalism. So in terms of the way it's all presented. So he hasn't had, I'll warn you now, he has not had a hand in those DVDs, which is why they're possibly not as professional as they could be. Right. But I did my best.
They're great, Simon. I think you did a fine job there. They're worth watching, and you know, all the info we need's there. It is great, though. It is great to have Mark there and sort of knocking the rough edges off you and making you presentable.
I needed someone to do it, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, there's lots of thanks coming up in the chat box. Thanks, folks, for listening and for your appreciation. And thanks, Simon and Mark, as ever, for coming on. It's always brilliant to talk to you.
No, thanks for having us, mate.
And, it's a pleasure.
We'll have you back on when things hot up again. I'm gonna hang around till midnight or so, folks. Put on a few tunes to drink some beer to. But in the meantime, this is from my mate Jakey Z in Glastonbury. It always goes down really well, and it's called Ted's Recycling Yard. Here we go. I'll be back with you in 10 minutes or so. Horace X there, and Mr. Sims doesn't like us. Well, Mr. Sims probably not the only one, eh? Not if we're doing our job properly. And that's off their album Burst Peacock, and before that The Jam and Eton Rifles. Next week on Dr. Rock's radio show, you're going to hopefully hear me chatting with Stella Berg, who's a lady I met probably 2 or 3 years ago at Bodenham Manor initially. And I think we're going to be talking about homeopathy and related subjects, but I know that she's got a wide field of interest, so conversation could go anywhere, I guess. In the meantime, thanks very much to raconteursnews.com for hosting me, and I'll play music up to the witching hour, kicking off with Iggy Pop's Wild One. Thanks for being there, all of you, in the chat, outside the chat, and in the pods, and I'll see you all next week, if everything's hanging together, eh?